Hello and welcome to In Focus with Insight. My name is Pamela Hillig. I'm head of Insight Life Solutions, and this is an episode of the Open Books series in which we get to know fascinating and inspiring people in the actuarial and insurance community through the books that they have read and loved. Today, I'm joined by the president of the Actuarial Society of South Africa, Costa Economo. Costa is the CEO and founder of Colourfield Liability Solutions, a liability-driven investment management boutique, the first and largest of its kind in South Africa, responsible for managing assets in respect to parastatal, government, municipal, and corporate-sponsored institutional investors. Costa is a qualified actuary, holds an MBA from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and is a CFA charter holder, amongst many other qualifications. He used to be an executive director and senior actuary at Alexander Forbes Financial Services, having worked there from 1992 to 2009. He is a former commissioner appointed by the President of South Africa to serve on the Independent Commission for the Remuneration of Public Office Bearers. Welcome, Costa.
Good to be here. Thank you, Pamela.
Costa, tell me, are you a reader?
I am a reader. I love books. I love learning. So yes, very definitely.
So happy to hear that because this isn't like your normal podcast interview in which we will get to know you and talk about things you're busy with and passionate about, but with the added angle of the books that have shaped you in some way. So you can think of it as the Desert Island Discs for bibliophiles.
I'm nervous. Thank you.
No need to be. We're all book lovers here.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's get started with a bit about you. What are you busy with these days?
At the moment, I'm particularly busy in our industry. Sort of October, November of every year is a very busy time in the retirement fund and investment space. Lots of trustee meetings, lots of report backs, lots of proposals, lots of presentations. So that's keeping me really busy. The Actuarial Society is also keeping me exceptionally busy. We're on a roadshow where we're meeting a number of employers, of which Insight will be one, where we're talking about what's going on in ASSA and sharing ideas with the employers. So quite a lot of work on that particular front. And of course, as we close in on the convention, quite a lot of preparatory work that's needed for that. So busy with that. And then I sit on a number of boards, and it's the sort of board cycle. And that is also keeping me very, very busy. I also have a set of twins who are in matric at the moment. So there's quite a lot of stress in the household, but yes, which is why this is a welcome respite from all of that. So thank you very much for the opportunity to step off the treadmill and you know, just talk about things that are more fun. So thank you.
Yeah, I think we all need that once in a while. And do you think your twins will follow in your footsteps and become actuaries?
Well, I know one of them is contemplating it, so he is the more sort of studious of the two. They're both very different. It really is chalk and cheese. You know, when they talk about star signs and how people born on a particular day share similar traits, similar characteristics, well, my set of twins are the antithesis of one another. And so, you know, puts to bed the argument that it actually holds true. So they are very different. The one is actually contemplating actuarial science or engineering. I'm not sure what he'll end up doing, but my sense is that he probably will become, or at least try to become, an actuary. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you'll share lots of pearls of wisdom of them along the way.
Yeah.
Before we get into the books that you brought along, I'd like to hear a bit about your reading habits and, you know, your relationship with books. So how would you describe your relationship with reading and with books?
So I think when I was at school, reading was the one thing I actually did not do. So you did not do enough of. So I grew up in a Greek home, and the Greek home meant that after school, I'd invariably do one of two things. I'd either be in the shop working with my parents or helping my parents out, or going to Greek school where I was learning to read, write, and speak Greek. So culturally, that's kind of like what we did. So there was very little time afforded sort of growing up in terms of access to books. And of course, back in those days, you know, prior to the internet and the ability to download books at your convenience, you'd have to go to a library, and the library was quite some distance away from where we lived. So it wasn't a very easy thing to access. I then got into university, and of course, you know, the nature of the books I was reading were just textbooks, you know, maths and stats and actuarial science, or the textbooks. And, you know, I, to be honest with you, I didn't enjoy the learning part of the actuarial degree. I enjoyed the social aspect of being at a university. I didn't really enjoy the academic sort of part of it. So I wasn't particularly studious or a very good student. And it was only once I finished university that I actually accidentally got into a sort of an actuarial position. And at that point, I started working for what remains to be one of my most inspiring sort of people, the CEO of the group. And it was him that basically got me motivated to pursue the career and become an actuary. And so my early sort of journey in books was really just academia and sort of the work that was needed to basically qualify. When I finished the qualification, it was at that point that I started picking up books. And I must say I found them an amazing escape. I generally look to read, fiction, and really just to escape just enjoy that escape. But then about 10 years later, after having qualified, I went back to studying and the nature of the books that I was then reading were more along the lines of, economics books, textbooks on, corporate finance and that sort of thing. So I read a lot. I've spent a lot of time reading and I continue to read a lot. I mean, it sort of takes its turn from stuff that I'm doing in terms of some sort of program or academic type sort of program, and when I'm not doing that, I'll sort of dive into fiction stories because I quite enjoy those. And I'm more a book lover than I am somebody that likes to see the movie of that same book. So for me, it's more about the book and the way it's been written, and I kind of like immerse myself in that imagination, and I'm quite an imaginative sort of person. So I kind of like create my own sort of story in my head, and I love that. I really do.
When you create those stories in your head, do you cast famous actors as the characters?
I actually do, yeah. So I kind of like think of what they might look like or what they should look like. And then when the movie does come out, it's often with disappointments that the person I imagined is not quite the person that's there, So there's a book that I read about 3 or 4 years ago. In fact, it was probably about 5 years ago, The Gentleman in Moscow. And I must say that it was a tough book to get through. It's beautifully written. It's probably the most well-written book I've ever read. It took me about 4 months to get through it.
Because it's heavy going.
It's quite heavy going. The language is heavy, but beautifully written. And I was also quite busy at work during that time. And so by the time I got to read the book, which is normally at night as I'm sort of getting into bed, I'm quite exhausted, and so whereas I'd like to get through a chapter, I invariably get through maybe half a paragraph and I'm fast asleep. But that was a beautifully written book, and they've recently created a production that's now on Apple TV, which I have downloaded, but I'm loath to actually watch it because I just loved the book so much, and I just don't want to be disappointed by the show. So I'm waiting to get some feedback on the show from people that I know loved the book, who are looking at the show. And so we'll see what that sort of pans out to be. Yeah.
So Gentleman in Moscow is one of the books that we're discussing today. What is the plot of that?
So it's basically a guy who was part of the bourgeoisie pre the Russian Revolution, and part of the elite. And effectively, he comes back into Moscow and is then placed under house arrest in a hotel. And it's really the story of how things around him started changing, with the advent of communism, the fall of the Tsar, kind of like how his engagements with people had to change and what was going on around him, given what he was used to and where he came from. So it's really a person that is enjoyed privilege, significant privilege up until that point. Suddenly that been robbed of him, and seeing communist ideology sort of filtering through. It's a fascinating story. And it's, you know, just the English is just beautifully written, you know, like it's just beautiful English. And so anybody looking for a good book, I would strongly recommend it. It's an amazing book to read, but it is heavy reading. It is heavy.
Okay. Where do you get your recommendations from?
Oh, it's mostly friends. It's mostly friends and people that I know that read, who share with me, kind of like, you know, their books. And so that's typically how it works. Yeah.
Okay, and you like reading for the language, I think.
Yeah, I love the language.
Yeah.
You know, I like to learn, you know, words. And again, it's kind of like the story. You know, life is just so busy and you're coming so hectic and crazy. And it's really just an opportunity to just escape. So if I'm on holiday, sitting on, you know, some deck or looking at the sea, it is one thing I like to do is read. You know, I just find it does relax me. It takes my mind off things and it energizes me. So it is something that I'm fascinated by. That said, I'm currently, I'm not currently reading anything other than forced reading, as a consequence of a program I've just registered for, on capitalism.
From communism to
capitalism. So I know very little about the concept of capitalism. I've never studied geopolitics or, you know, ideologies like communism, capitalism, socialism and the like. And you know, it's been offered by the University of Chicago, which I'm an alma mater and an alumni. You know, they are sort of a faculty or a school that is very prominent in the economic sphere. And I felt that, you know, if I'm going to learn something, this is a great place to learn it. And there was an opportunity presented to me to apply for participation in the program. They basically take, I don't know, 15 or so people across the world into it. And it's an 11 or 12 week program. And what you do is you basically get a whole lot of readings, you know, tons of readings. So over the last 2 weeks, I think I've read about 1,000 pages of text and a book called The Company. It's a book that basically talks about the formation of companies and, you know, goes back into time as to how they sort of arrived and along that way kind of talks about the merits or demerits of capitalism and capitalist ideas. And so for me, what's great about this is when I'm learning something, it is interesting. And the reason I was quite keen to sort of learn about it was just this notion of inequality. I'm finding that is something that I'm really struggling with as a human, as a person. And it's not just inequality that we observe here in South Africa, which, you know, is obviously by far the worst in the world, you know, societally at least. But it's inequality of nations, of companies. You look at, for example, the big nations. They're just growing bigger. The smaller nations are just getting smaller. You know, within nations, societies, you know, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. Organizations, companies, you look at the Big Seven, the Magnificent Seven, as they call them in the US, I think they account for something like 30%, 31% of total share value on the stock market. Seven companies.
Which are some of those seven?
So like the likes of Meta, Apple,
all the tech companies,
you know, all the big tech sort of organizations. And just that gap seems to be widening. And for me, I want like an answer to that. I want to understand what's driving it. And I want to understand what's possible to kind of like prevent it, because I don't think it's good that we have it's certainly not good that we have such levels of inequality across all spheres. And so that's kind of like what motivated me to get into this program. And so the book or the reading that I'm currently doing is like forced reading, you know, through this program. So yeah, so that's kind of like what I'm involved with at the moment.
I'm very curious now about the writing within this. Gentleman Oscar, do you have a quote?
I have a quote. I sent it through. Yeah, so there is a quote that that really resonated with me. It says, yeah, if a man does not master his circumstances, then he's bound to be mastered by them. And I think what you'll find throughout was a common theme across most of the books. In fact, all the books that I sent through is this theme of resilience. You know, I find that and it's something that appeals to me. At a personal level, resilience is something that I've had to rely on to kind of like deal with difficulty and challenging sort of times. And it's resilience that I think is the thing that stood out for me the most. And here is a guy who was an elitist, had all sorts of privilege, you know, rightly or wrongly, he had privilege, and suddenly that had been taken away from him, and how he had to respond to that. And I think your response to change, particularly harsh change, I think is what makes you what you might be one day. I think that's what defines you. And for me, you know, it's kind of like a theme that I think I quite like in books is characters that demonstrate that resilience, you know, that toughness, that strength in character.
I'd like to touch on that by, you know, talking a bit about your upbringing and your background. So you mentioned that your parents had a shop.
Yeah.
You know, how did you go from, you know, that upbringing to, you know, to something very academic and then, you know, later to entrepreneurial again, I guess. You know, what was that then?
It was completely by accident. I mean, you know, so we were brought up with this, you know, in this business. In fact, my parents were both immigrants from Greece, both born and raised in Greece, and left Greece consequence of what was going on in Greece at the time. You know, the Second World War was devastating on Greece. Shortly after that, there was a civil war where there was a communist uprising. And that was even more devastating for Greece. And then just after that, there was this massive earthquake that, you know, was incredibly damaging. So jobs were scarce. People had no prospects and were forced economically to basically pursue opportunities globally. My father had a cousin that was based in Maputo, what was then known as Lorenzo Marx, and it was she that encouraged him to come out to South Africa. And so he did that. His brother followed suit, and you know, being people that didn't speak, read, or write English, were forced into a trade of, you know, shopkeeping, you know, working for somebody, you know, in a shop, a sort of cash business. And then he got his opportunity to open up his own, and kind of like that's how things started for him.
Was it like a corner shop, like a cafe? It's
exactly that stereotype, you know. So we were in a corner, and it was a cafe. You know, my mother and he went back to basically marry my mother. It was an arranged marriage. She then came out. I mean, she met my dad, and within 2 weeks, I was now living in a foreign country, having to speak a foreign language. It was really tough, not knowing anybody. It was really, really tough. And so that's kind of like what they knew. You know, we were raised in that sort of family. We never once went on holiday together. They basically worked 7 days a week, 16-hour days, 365 days of the year. So we never got to see our parents other than when we were at the shop. So kind of like that's where we were brought up. It taught us many things, you know, like being in the shop taught us, firstly, the struggle, that's needed to kind of like just survive. We understood the value of ethical work and important work. You know, the value system that came out of it was second to none. So academically I was not bad at school, but you know, I never knew of this world of actuarial science. It was never something that was known to us. I mean, back in those days, it was obviously something that was not that well known anyway. But I sort of stumbled across it in my final year of school, in my matric year, where I went for social counseling to help me understand what it is that I might be good at and what it is that I should study. My plan on studying was to basically get a degree and then go back straight to the business and help my dad and take over the shop. That was kind of like the plan. And when I stumbled across actuarial science, which I was encouraged to look at, it kind of like it appealed to me because it had maths as a key sort of subject and business. But I didn't appreciate the nature of the type of business, you know? So I kind of like went into it fairly cold. Mm. There was very little in terms of research. There was absolutely no actuary I could speak to. So I arrived at university, not really knowing what an actuary is all about, but excited by the prospect of getting a degree in 3 or 4 years and then going back to the business, you know? Anyway, my life at varsity was not bad. I loved it socially. And then when I finished, I went back to the business. Of course, at that stage, the business was taking strain because the supermarkets were growing, you know, the big spas were growing. And so we were unable to compete with them. And so, you know, the struggle of maintaining both myself and my dad in the shop, or, you know, was just not possible. So I had to go and find work at the time. Alexander Forbes were interviewing, and so on hands and knees, I basically begged for a job.
I believe literally.
Literally, I was on hands and knees. I begged for a job. I went to the interview, and I think they've never seen anybody literally get down on his knees and actually ask for the job. And that's exactly what I did.
Interview tips.
Yeah, interview tips.
Yeah.
And I think they saw in me somebody that just had this I guess this eagerness to do work, you know.
Yeah.
And employed me, and my first job was that of an archive filer, you know, at the bottom of N Street. You know, the business was based in Sauer Street in Joburg, but I was sent to N Street in the archives, and all I was doing was filing for 2 months in a suit. Kind of like, so that was my, I wasn't even a trainee actuarial assistant. I kind of like, you know, that was my role, and that's how I started.
Okay, but you had an actuarial degree.
Yeah, so I got the degree, and then because of that degree, eventually got into the actuarial team as a trainee actuarial assistant, and got to work for Graham Kerrigan, who remains one of the most inspiring people for me. And that's what kind of like motivated me to then pursue the field. So I registered with the Institute of Actuaries and started the exams, and thankfully got through them relatively quickly. Absolutely loved the profession. And I must say, it's been the best thing I've ever done. I love being an actuary. I love the actuarial field. And it's been so good to me, you know, given where I came from, it's been so good to me that I felt I needed to give back, which is why I'm sort of involved with the society. It's not just recent. I mean, the Retirement Matters Committee before this, you know, council now, you know, the work that we do, it's just to give back, because it's just been so good to me. So yeah, that's why I'm involved. So that's my journey. Yeah.
Oh yeah, very like a 2 minute version. I'm
yeah.
excited to hear more about it. But what's the next book we'll talk about today?
The next book of what I maybe read. We can talk about so that Where the Crawdads Sing is an interesting book.
Oh, I love that one.
You like it? Have you read it? Yeah,
it's yeah. Brilliant.
So I picked it up because I was told it's light reading. so which was unlike the gentleman in Moscow.
Yeah.
And I also loved that book. I found it. I actually binged read that.
I
wanted to get to the end.
Yeah.
And so I think I finished it in a day and a half or whatever. You know, on a December holiday down in Durban. So it was right by the pool, listening to some music in the background. Enjoying good weather and just loving the story and imagining the story. And unlike Gentleman in Moscow, whose movie I have not yet seen, I saw the movie that subsequently came out.
Yeah.
Actually, I wasn't disappointed with it. I thought it was a fairly good demonstration of the book. And one that was not necessarily inconsistent with what was in my head. You know?
Yeah.
So I quite enjoyed that book. And again, it's that resilience that appealed to me, that the strength in that character, in that girl's and Kyra's sort of character and the strength to kind of like get through what it is that she had to face. That appealed to me. So I just loved that about that book. But it was easy reading, I must say. And it was just a great story.
Yeah, and it's written like poetry.
Yeah, exactly.
But easy reading poetry.
Easy reading, yeah, it's easy reading. So it was just a very enjoyable book. And if anybody has never read a book, that is serious
book start.
That you can start with. It's just a wonderful read.
Do you like a physical book, or do you read on Kindle, audiobook?
I prefer a physical book, but I find that accessing a physical book these days is just a bit more challenging. So I kind of, I do both, but I do prefer the physical book. I like the feel of the paper and being able to turn. And I think what makes it more special is the fact that you can see the pages that you have read. You kind of like can see that you're getting towards the end. Of course, you can do that with a Kindle as well, because it gives you the percentage.
Yeah.
But you know, when you see it, it just feels better. I don't know. I prefer the physical feel of the book. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the definite camps of people and their preferences, and all are valid, I suppose. Do you have a favorite quote from this book?
Yeah. A quote that I did that did resonate with me. Was there are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. And again, I think that quote sort of talks to the main character's closeness with nature, which also appeals to me. I love nature. I love the wild. I love the bush. We have a home in Belito, which is in a forest, and it gives me no greater pleasure than to travel there and just escape. So I love, and for me, nature is an escape. It is like a book. It is that escape that appeals to me, and it gives me that peace of mind. It allows me to kind of like think, to gather my thoughts, to kind of like, you know, contemplate stuff. So for me, that is appealing, and that's certainly very, very present in the book. Yeah,
I'm interested in how you came to start Color Field. First of all, where's the name from?
Okay,
and then a more general question: what is liability-driven investment?
Okay, no, it's a two great questions. So Color Field has got nothing to do with financial services, as you can appreciate. It's in fact an art movement. So I'm a big lover of the arts. Yeah, my favorite artist is William Turner. A massive lover of his work. I love the drama in color, and that's what he has. If you look at any of his paintings, or his work, he basically makes landscapes. He brings them alive. You know, like he'll when you look at his work, it's almost a picture, and you can see the movement. And that, I think, is what I love about his work. Color Field was an art movement that was started by two artists, Rothkowitz and Gottlieb, about 100 or so years ago. So it's literally to the day. At that time, art was very much doom and gloom. You know, they'd just gone through the First World War. There was the Russian Revolution. There was their pandemic. You know, you'll remember, well, you won't remember, but I mean, there was the pandemic of 100 or so years ago. You would have studied about it. And so every artist basically painted stuff that was just, you know, full of doom and gloom, that miserable sort of stuff. And these guys came along, and it was a brush of color, freshness, you know, just a change. And when we were thinking about a name, we felt that as a movement kind of like resonated with what it is that we were about. We wanted to get into asset management. We were all
actually. Who's we?
I'll give you an. So it's basically my former university professor, Dr. Nick Sennett,
okay.
who and Sean Leviton. So it was the three of us that basically formed the company. We also had two colleagues who joined us from Alexander Forbes, Terry Gavson and Troy Duplessis. So there were five of us. And when we sort of thought about the name, what resonated with us is that these guys were different at a time where difference was needed. And so that's what we wanted to be. We wanted to be investment actuaries that did asset management in a very different way. So that's where the name comes from. And if you look at the name, it's got, if you look at the word color, it's got OLO, and that OLO can look like a percentage sign. And of course, that appealed to the actuaries in us.
Who figured that out?
Yeah,
graphic designer.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. We actually didn't have a graphic designer at the start, but yeah. So I guess it was collective. You know, Terry, you know, being the only lady amongst us, was the most creative amongst us. So I think we owe a lot to her for her creativity. So what we do is you know, we call ourselves liability driven investment managers, and really what an LDI manager is when you manage money, with a specific objective of following or tracking the liability of the institution that you're managing money for. So if you look at a pension fund, it's got assets and liabilities. The liability is, you know, the present value of a series of cash flows from day to day, from month to month. That value sort of changes because of things like interest rates and inflation. So what we do is we build portfolios that'll basically track that change. So we're almost like a de-risking solution. We effectively take risk off the table, and we help secure the obligations that those institutions are obliged to pay. So we secure the ability to pay the pension, and we secure the ability to provide increases on that pension. So the business has been, you know, and when we engineered the concept, it was the first time ever in South Africa that you had an LDI solution. So we, you know, we're innovative in terms of, you know, bringing it to the market. But of course, the challenge was in educating the market of their need for such a solution. And it was a really tough time. I think the first sort of year or two of our business, it was really tough. We had numerous appointments, new business opportunities. presentation second to none. And, at the end of the year, I think we had one appointment that we had to show for all that effort. So it was a tough time to try and sort of get through. But thankfully, and not to take it for granted in any way or form, the business has demonstrated success. We've been able to secure wonderful appointments, amazing clients, the business has grown from strength to strength. We don't employ lots of people. We've got in total about 14 people, of which 7 are actuaries. There are 3 actuarial students. So it's very actuarially sort of dominated because of the nature of what it is that we're tracking as a benchmark. You need to understand liabilities and what's driving them. But all the actuaries and all the sort of folk involved have also got the sort of, important investment skill and qualification and experience. And so that's kind of like what we do. Yeah. In the defined contribution fund space, which is, unlike the defined benefit fund space, we've, as a consequence of, networks, we've also been able to connect with, famous people across the world. So Bob Merton, Professor Robert Merton, who is the Nobel Prize laureate. We are personal friends with him. We've done work with him. He's collaborated with us on a solution that we are sort of taking to the market. The market has responded very encouragingly by it. So notwithstanding that we're a small business, our sort of line of sight and our reach has been amazing. We're very humbled by just the extent to which we've been able to connect with these folk and some of the opportunities that have been presented before us. So it's been an amazing journey. And if I were to do it all over again, I absolutely would, as much as it's been a tough journey. Yeah.
On a very practical note, that first year when, you had meeting after meeting without success, how did you sustain yourself? Did you have savings? What was your plan?
It's not to be recommended, but I basically went into significant debt. My sort of decision at the time was motivated by, so we had an unfortunate incident of crime occurred to me. Whilst I was at Alexander Forbes, I had this thing happening to me and I got quite rattled by it. At the time, twins had just been born. They were like 18 months old and that's what rattled me. And so what I was encouraged to do, I'm a big lover of South Africa. I'm somebody that's completely committed to South Africa's cause and the country. I absolutely love it. And this is despite the fact that many of my peers, people that I studied with, a lot of them have in fact left. I was very committed. But this incident of crime rattled me a bit, and I was encouraged at that point to look at doing an MBA, but with one of the big sort of schools globally, because that's what gets you into a network, and that's what might create an opportunity. And I picked up The Economist, and The Economist does a survey annually of the best MBA schools, and at the top was the University of Chicago. So I thought, I'm going to just try with them. Apply anyway. I went through a very rigorous sort of process of applying and what have you. And managed to get in. And of course, having got in, I suddenly was doing this program. And I think that's what gave me the confidence to step out of my comfort zone and actually try something on my own. But when I left Alexander Forbes, I didn't leave with, a whole lot of savings. In fact, what I ended up doing was taking my retirement fund savings. It's the exact thing that you should not be doing, and then investing it in the business. So I invested it in the business. We didn't have any clients. There were 5 actuaries in the business. So of course, an expensive business to run. But I just went into debt. And so the incentive to try and make it work was growing by the day. My backstop in sort of doing it was, I felt that, if this thing doesn't succeed, I'll then go back to a corporate job and, continue to work in the way that I did before. And that would sort of get me out of whatever sort of difficulty I might have faced. But I just loved the people I was doing this with. And that's kind of like what kept me there. And our drive and passion to succeed is what kept us motivated. So and of course, the fact that we had a whole lot of debt against us meant that we had to make it work. And so that's, it's funny how debt kind of like you know, focuses your attention and, you know, success or achieving or trying to achieve success. So it kind of like gave us the drive that we needed to. But, you know, you know, when you have, I don't know, we had like 264, I think, meetings the first year, and we only had one appointment at the end of it. It is a bit demotivating when you have that sort of level of success rate coming through.
But what motivated you to stick with it?
I just felt we were believers in our solution. We felt our solution and our the way in which we did things actually resonated with what, you know, those funds needed. So that is kind of like what kept us going. It was almost the solution itself. We had such belief in, and we wanted to show how it actually does work, you know.
What's the third book we're going to talk about? I hope it's the one I want to talk about.
So The Captain Corelli's Mandolin. Yeah, so that was another very, very difficult read. I must say, the first 100 pages or so of that book, I was struggling to understand why it is that I was reading that book, because it really, like, it was a real struggle. The English was really difficult. It's also a very well-written book. The English is very difficult. I found aspects of it in the beginning quite funny, but not enough to kind of like keep me going. So I kind of like kept putting it down, picking it up. And the reason I kept picking it up was two things. One, I don't like to stop what I started.
Yeah.
I'm that sort of personality. I'll sort of get to the end regardless of what that thing might be. So I need to finish things off. I don't leave things. I'm not somebody that like leaves things midway. And the second thing is that I had, I think, a close friend of mine who loved the book. And I trusted her judgment a lot. So I felt that I needed to get to it, you know. And from about page 100 or so, it starts getting good and starts getting interesting. It's a fascinating story of, it's basically a love story set on the island of Kefalonia, which for me is one of the most beautiful places in the world. I've visited it 3 times, and every time I go back, I find and discover something different.
Did you go because of the book?
I went because of the book. And in fact, it became popular because of the book. Suddenly, the world found or discovered Kefalonia. You know, people like Madonna, for example, bought homes in Kefalonia because of the movie that was subsequently produced with
Nicolas Cage.
I love the stories. I love the story of the guy, the old man who, you know, was brought up being deaf, only to realize in his old age that in fact he was never deaf. It was just that he had a pea stuck in his ear. The doctor removed it and suddenly he could hear. But what I loved about that story, or that part of it, is that he went back a few days later to say, please put the pea back in because, you know, my wife is shouting at me and I can't handle it anymore. So I love that. I love that aspect of it. The love story is amazing. You know, an Italian officer and a local girl, and it's just, you know, the crossing of boundaries. You know, it's just amazing. And of course, for Greece, it was particularly poignant. That particular time. I mean, just the other day, the 28th of October is celebrated as Ochi Day, which means no. And that was the first time ever that the Allied powers won a war against the Axis powers in the Second World War. So, and Greece's role in that was defining to the outcome of the Second World War. And, you know, you'll read quotes of, you know, by Winston Churchill, who talks about the Greeks fighting in the Second World War and how they shaped the outcome of the war. The consequence of the defeat, you know, of Italy, meant that the Germans had to then go in. And I think the Greeks resisted for about 10 months, which I think was the longest amongst all the European nations. Mm-hmm. But they eventually fell. But that war between Germany and Greece is what ultimately led to Germany delaying its approach into Russia. So much so that they had to go in the winter, and ultimately it was that was key and instrumental to their defeat. So for me it was relevant amongst many, many sort of areas. And there is a quote that comes from the book that I've actually used at least twice at a wedding, where I've been either an MC or a best man of love. If I may read.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So the quote talks of goes as follows. It says, "Love is a temporary madness. it erupts like volcanoes and then subsides. And when it subsides, you have to make a decision. You have to work out whether your roots are so entwined together that it is inconceivable that you should ever part, because this is what love is. And I think that is, you know, that is so key. That is so true. And, you know, anybody contemplating married life, for example, or a long partnership with anybody should read this quote. I think it's so powerful because, you know, it really is how it's meant to be. You know, it really is quite defining. Yeah.
I'm interested in how you view your identity, because you love South Africa, you know, born here, passionate about the South African future, yet very strongly Greek. Identifies Greek as well. How do you balance those things? How would you define yourself?
I think it makes me quite unique. I mean, I'm not, you know, there's, I don't know, maybe there's 100,000 others that are both Greek and South African. I think if you talk to all of them, I think there is a strong sense of pride and of the place they come from or from where their ancestors come from. And at the same time, I think there's a huge love for South Africa and what South Africa has done for them as a family. You know, bearing in mind, most people that are here that come from that environment came from a difficult time. South Africa presented some opportunity. It wasn't as though the opportunity was an open door opportunity. They had to work hard to basically, you know, get themselves out of poverty, you know, help their children, you know, get some success. I think the key to success for most of those folk was education. I think a lot of them felt that, you know, being in Greece would deprive the prospects of their children and their children's children ever having access to an education system. So that was the key. And the fact that they were able to school their children and get their children to go on, you know, become doctors and lawyers and actuaries and engineers and what have you, is kind of like the success that they were looking for. So I think yet one cannot ignore what Greece was for them. And certainly I, you know, as somebody who is a Greek South African, I have a strong sense of pride for the Greek for Greece and Hellenism and what Greece has taught me and my people, and what it has done for the rest of the world. It's something that I reflect on often, and I absolutely love that. Yet, you know, given what I've experienced in South Africa, you know, it's also been a remarkable time to have grown up in South Africa, you know, like to have witnessed the fall of apartheid, to have witnessed the success that this country has had and its challenges as well. I think we've had some enormous challenges and we continue to have enormous challenges. And I think that makes it for a very interesting place. But I'm very passionate about this place. So yeah, don't ask me who I'd be supporting if Greece were to ever play against South Africa in a game of soccer. I have no sense. I'd be quite indifferent between.
I'd be happy either way.
I'd be happy either way.
Yeah.
I know Greece would never play South Africa rugby because Greeks aren't great rugby players. And equally, I don't think South Africa would ever play Greece in a game of basketball. You know, so thankfully our paths don't cross that often. But you know, I'm proudly Greek when Greece is playing, and I'm proudly South African when South Africa plays. I love both places. I make a point to go back to Greece at least once a year, and love being there. A lot of our family is still there. My cousins, aunts, uncles, a lot of them are still there. I just love the place. It's beautiful. But you know, South Africa is certainly the most special for me. You know?
Okay, South Africa's home.
Yeah. So I mean, in terms, maybe I'm a confused Greek South African, but I'm a strongly Greek South African. So that's my identity. It's a unique identity. I have a leg in each place, you know.
And luckily, you can be both.
Yes, exactly.
No reason not to.
Yeah.
So I think we have time for two other honorable mentions. Maybe if we can list them and tell me what you love about them. Yeah.
So there's two other people, and these are biographies, which I generally don't read. The first is Nelson Mandela, who for me was an interesting character because I was brought up in an apartheid regime where I was told that this is a man that's a terrorist. You know, you know, like that's what was going on in our homes. You know, like our media was censored. What we got to see was not the reality of the situation. But when I sort of, as I grew older, I began to think for myself, and the, you know, human rights and the sort of right to live freely in a place, you know, started becoming an important thing to me. And when I went to university, I kind of like witnessed it firsthand. And so his struggle, his journey, really was interesting to me. And what he did in saving South Africa from a civil war, which he had every ability to basically enact, is to this day for me absolutely miraculous. Like, now I'm always emotional when I think of that, because we're literally teetering on the brink of a civil war at the time. And the fact that, you know, when Chris Hani's assassination took place, kind of like that's the sort of thing that creates wars, you know, like it's that sort of event that kind of like completely, you know, brings a nation down. And what he did when he had the power to pursue a war, and he had the power to basically take what was rightfully something that he would have had access to, for him to have encouraged kind of cohesion and diplomacy and discussion and peaceful transition, I think was just remarkable. You know, so I think for me he's like a hero. And you know, not that I want to throw religion into this, but when they talk about, you know, a second coming, you know, it's that sort of person that is representative of what a second coming might look like. You know, it's that's the sort of significance that I think he had in my world, you know? So, and the world of around us, you know. So for me, his journey was really remarkable. And I mean, there are many books by Nelson Mandela, but the one that you know, in his book Long Walk to Freedom, which is, I mean, it should be compulsory reading, I think, for everybody in this country, and in fact not just this country, I think it should be compulsory reading for everybody, because I think there are such lessons in that. You know, the American politicians, I think, would stand to gain tremendous just by reading his story. So, I mean, it's quite a long quote that I've got here. It says, yeah, I've walked that long road to freedom. I've tried not to falter. I've made missteps along the way, but I've discovered the secret that after climbing a great hill, one only finds that there are many more hills to climb. I've taken a moment here to rest, to steal a view of the glorious vista that surrounds me. I look back on the distance I've come, but I can only rest for a moment, for with freedom comes responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not ended. And I think that talks to, certainly like it feels as though, like if I read this about kind of like my journey, there's a lot of stuff there that like resonates with me. And it's inspiring to kind of like hear leaders like that talk about kind of like the journeys that they've had to go through to get to the point that they are. I think that is a huge thing. So
yeah, I got goosebumps listening to that, and
it's fantastic.
Being reminded of the miracle.
No, it's an amazing thing. And I think when people start accusing our government and accusing our, you know, like what goes on about various things, I'm not suggesting that these are false accusations. Of course they're not. Everybody wants what's right for the country. But where we came from and what we've achieved is miraculous. And we must hold on to that miracle and just build on it, because I think our potential is enormous. You know, like the diversity of people and skill and culture that we have here is second to none. And I think diversity is hugely powerful. So that is something that really resonates with me.
Unity and diversity as our national motto goes,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And then the last book I want to talk of is a book of a person that for me has been incredibly iconic. And if you were to say, who's my sporting hero? Rafael Nadal represents that. You know, disappointingly, like it's been a dark man for me because he's just announced his retirement. He has been somebody that has been hugely inspiring, and he's been inspiring for various reasons. One, I think his humility is incredible and second to none. His sportsmanship is incredible and second to none. His grit and his determination is really what appeals to me about him. Like, I love the fact that he's just such a fighter, that he just never gives up. And I think if there is an inspiration out there of somebody that, despite injury, of which he's had much, despite difficulty, of which he's had much, to rise above that and still succeed, I think is incredible. And again, it's this theme of resilience, you know, If you look at his sort of track record, he has been by far the most injured amongst the sort of top players, and his success is remarkable. I think I think he's missed something like, I don't know, 23 Grand Slams through injury. So he's just not, and it's the nature of his game. It's so physical, which means that his body takes a lot more damage. And despite that, when he is healthy and he is able to play, he kind of like gives more of himself. Like Roger Federer, I think, is a more talented player. He's got the edge of on him. Novak Djokovic is another guy that's got amazing grit, a great mental strength, very talented. But his head-to-head against Nadal in the key moments is not as good as Nadal's. So it's just an amazing, amazing. He's an amazing guy. So it's quite displeasing for me that he's actually now come to an end in terms of his tennis career. But yeah, the quote that he's got in his story, in his biography, it says, "Enduring means accepting things as they are and not as you wish them to be, and then looking ahead, not behind." So it's that acceptance that you might have challenges, you might have difficulties, put those behind you and move forward, look ahead. And I think we can all sort of learn from that. Like we often feel, like an actuarial student failing an exam. You can sit and, be miserable and upset about it, but that doesn't help the situation. You've got to accept it. Or you might not have been able to make an exam because, of difficulties with work or whatever it might be. Accept it, move on. Life's too short. You can't sort of sit and ponder on what might have been, think of what could be, and that's what one, must look towards. So that's another book that I think was great.
Okay, so those were five amazing books. A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, Captain Corelli's Mandolin by Louis de Bernière. Is that the right pronunciation? Rafa, My Story by Rafael Nadal, and Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela. I ask everyone the same question. If I had to be very cruel and send you away to a desert island with only one of these books, which one would it be?
Sure, that's a really difficult question. With only one of these books, I guess probably Mandela. Along, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it'll keep you busy the longest as well.
Exactly. Yeah, it's by far the longest. That's but not the most difficult of reads. The most difficult of reads was, I think, I guess that Captain Corelli's Mandolin was tough to get through. The first 100 pages were tough, but I mean, it's just a
That's so rewarding.
beautiful
Wow.
story.
Yeah, I remember the love story between the soldier and his ally, right? Which is also
Yeah,
very special.
it's special, and it again it talks about cross-cultural boundaries and things like
Yeah.
that, which was also, when the book was released, that was obviously a theme, in modern society. So it was interesting to kind of like get a sense of, how that played out. Yeah.
So, last question, actually, double-barreled question.
Yeah.
First, what are your plans for ASUS or during, the rest of your term as president? And where can people get hold of you if they'd like to follow your journey?
Oh right, okay. So the last question I'll deal with first because it's
Easier.
just call me. My number is 0828526031,
We'll put up one.
or send me an email, costa@colorfield.co.za. I believe I've got an ASSA address, president@actuarialscience.edu.
Actuarialscience.org. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm completely accessible. Anybody can get a hold of me. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Facebook. I'm not. If you need to get a hold of me, you will get a hold of me. And I'm always available. So please, by all means, get a hold of me. If you need to chat about anything, so that's always a thing. In terms of ASSA, I'm lucky in that I'm accompanied on my journey by amazing people. The people at council, the people at the office, they're all amazing people. And so my journey is a lot easier than it would be normally, I think. We've got great thinkers, people that actually want to do the right thing. Everybody, I guess every president or every person at council feels like they want to make a difference. And certainly the reason they're involved is because they want to make a difference. And one mustn't underestimate the sort of extent of time it takes outside of your normal life to try and make a difference. I got involved because I want to make a difference. I want to give back because I think the profession has been incredibly meaningful to me and you know, life-changing to me. For me, it's important that as a profession, we recognize what it is that we have as a skill, and that we are seen to be relevant. You know, that actually when people think of the actuarial profession, they think of a good place. They think of an organization that is actually helping to change and make a difference. And of course, here in South Africa, there are huge things that we need to tackle. You know, like you look at the retirement fund system and the lack of provision amongst the broader base, the lack of social security. You know, in your world, or in the business world of Insights, NHI, for example, is a massive thing. I mean, there's no doubt that we need broader healthcare coverage. You know, actuaries are people that just have the skill set to kind of like understand those issues and help solve those problems. And there are many. I mean, you know, our infrastructure and our government's balance sheet and the ability to use capital of institutions in a deliberate way that doesn't compromise those institutions' fiduciary responsibilities, but at the same time ensures that the capital, when deployed, is actually creating, you know, jobs. It's creating sustainable sort of energy and water sort of rights and privilege. I mean, these are things that are hugely important. And I think as a profession, we are so well poised to kind of like make such a meaningful difference. And relevance is the key sort of theme that we've taken on as a council. So if I can in any way you know, help to change that, and I cannot do it alone, I certainly, you know, recognize the task before me, but if we can even make a dent on that, I think it would be fantastic. So that's kind of like what we're hoping to do, is just to increase our relevance. It's not to say that actuaries have not been relevant in the past, of course they have, but it's to continue to be relevant. And of course, to be relevant, you've also got to be appropriately transformed. And I think one of the things that as an organization we have recognized is that as much as we've done a lot of stuff in terms of helping achieve that objective, it's not at the level and pace at which we think is acceptable to us all. So we are doing some deliberate things in terms of helping to change that and trying to understand why it hasn't changed as quickly as we'd like it to change. So very exciting times, and very exciting time to be involved with ASSA. And ASSA as a body, I think, just an exceptional organization, highly regarded amongst the global actuarial fraternity. We always punch above our weight. We take on big tasks. Peter Withy, for example, the former president of ASSA, he's running an AI task team, which is one of the two key sort of themes and strategies that the IAA have taken on. So as an organization, our members are well represented globally, and we are highly, highly regarded globally for the work that we as a South African body does. Compliments too to the strong academic foundation that generates the students that we need to basically get into the system, and certainly working alongside them and all the participants, all the volunteers, the honoraria members, you know, everybody that has any role to play. I mean, it's a massive effort, and it requires that level of coordination to be successful. So very excited to be part of it, of the team, and very excited to be able to give back something, you know.
Yeah, we as members, we're so grateful to have, you know, enthusiastic, passionate people like you leading the profession. So thank you.
No, thank you very much. Thank you, Pamela. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
It's been wonderful.
I've really enjoyed the time, and really enjoyed meeting and speaking with you. And best of luck for the balance of the year. It's critical that we're now sort of on the cusp of November, 6 or 7 weeks of work left, and then it's...
Feels like it should already be.
Exactly. I think we're all exhausted.
So I have a gift for you.
Thank you so much, Pam. Honestly, not necessary. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I usually like to give books I've read myself, but this is a recommendation from Christoph. Nexus by Yuval Noah Harari.
Fantastic.
I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he wrote Sapiens. And
Yes, I've read Sapiens, which is brilliant. So I'm looking forward to this. This is amazing.
Yeah, and personal recommendation from Christoph.
No, thank you so much. And thank you, Christoph, then, for the recommendation. And what is also amazing, and probably why Christoph also chose it, is that It's such a thick book. I could actually stand on it and give myself some height, which as a vertically challenged individual, you know, it's something that certainly might come in handy. But no, thank you so much for this. This is amazing. I look forward to reading it.
Looking forward to your review.
I absolutely will. No, thank you so much. It'll be when I finish this course, which will be middle of January when I'll get to it, but I definitely will get to it. I look forward to reading about it because Sapiens is just brilliant.
Yeah, and I think this has to do with AI and technology, which themes you touched on.
Loved it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Thank you so much. Can I give you a hug?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kostas.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you, Pan. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. All the best.